Hey guys, welcome back to Med Talks. This episode is part of our Finals Countdown series, a series of revision episodes for all of you medical students, in other words, the future of our NHS, where we're providing some short but super useful talks on common conditions across all specialties. Today, we're still working our way through the gastrointestinal system, and I'll be talking about irritable bowel syndrome. I'll be covering what irritable bowel syndrome is, the different causes, how it presents, how we diagnose it, and then how we manage it. So, let's get straight into the episode. As always, please remember to give us your feedback so we know how you are finding our episodes. You can leave a comment for us on the Apple Podcast platform and subscribe to our social media platforms for plenty more updates. Now, before we get into this episode, I'd just like to take a moment to talk about the sponsors, and they are Wesleyan. Wesleyan is a company that was set up way back in 1841, and they provide tailored financial advice and products to multiple professional groups, including doctors, dentists, and teachers. I'd like to just touch on Wesleyan's latest project called The Next Step. The Next Step is born from the Wesleyan tradition of giving back. Built in collaboration with final year students, The Next Step brings together some of the brightest sparks in medicine for live events, workshops, exam resources, content, and podcasts to make the step into F1 a little easier. They address subject matter you didn't know you needed to know. So go on over and follow them on Instagram by searching The Wes Next Step, or Facebook by searching The Next Step-Wesleyan, or visit their website by entering thenextstep.wesleyan.co.uk. Right then, let's get back to the episode. So what is irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS? Previously, IBS was referred to as a spastic or a nervous colon or a spastic bowel. Now, sadly, IBS can be quite debilitating, and it occurs in around 10 to 20% of the UK population. Although it's probably more than that because people don't seek help with it. It's more commonly found in women with a peak prevalence between 20 and 30 years old. So essentially, it's a functional bowel disorder which relapses and recurs. It involves abdominal pain with fluctuating bowel habits, and this is the most common feature. Now let's explore why it happens. Unfortunately, as with many conditions in medicine, there is no single underlying cause or factor to explain the condition. There is also no structural lesion, but there are a number of associations and theories which can be of some benefit when it comes to learning about IBS. So it's thought to involve some abnormal smooth muscle activity within the bowel and some visceral hypersensitivity. There is thought to be some abnormal central processing of painful stimuli, and it's often associated with psychiatric distress and poor coping strategies. IBS can be subclassified according to the main feature. So there's IBS-C, which is IBS with constipation, IBS-D, which is IBS with diarrhea as the predominant feature, and IBS-M, so where there's both hard and soft stools. Now let's talk about the presenting features. So according to the NICE guidelines, patients will give a 6-month history of either abdominal pain or discomfort, bloating, or a change in bowel habit, so either constipation or diarrhea. The abdominal pain is typically relieved by defecation. A morning rush is common where patients feel the urgent need to defecate several times on getting up, during and after breakfast. And symptoms may relapse due to stress or change in bowel flora, which may be secondary to antibiotic therapy. Patients with IBS may also experience some upper GI symptoms, which may include nausea, heartburn, dysphagia and early satiety. And then there are some extra intestinal symptoms and signs that patients may experience, such as headaches and migraine, asthma, backache, lethargy, dyspareunia, urinary frequency, urgency, and psychiatric problems, so anxiety and depression. On examination, patients will have generalized tenderness, and the signs are pretty nonspecific. So let's talk about investigations. The diagnosis of IBS should be made positively on symptom-based criteria. So we need to carefully elicit a history and carry out the appropriate and thorough physical examination, It's important to elicit a patient's family history, so any history of inflammatory bowel disease or colon cancer at an age younger than 40, because this would then lower the threshold for further investigations or referrals. Patients that meet the symptomatic criteria for IBS should have blood tests done, so full blood count, and either an ESR or CRP, which is more typically used, a celiac screen to exclude that, a CA125 for women with symptoms which could be ovarian cancer, such as change in bowel habits or abdominal bloating, and fecal calprotectin to exclude any inflammatory bowel disease. There are some tests which are not required to confirm IBS in those patients who meet the diagnostic criteria, and these are thyroid function, ultrasound, a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy, fecal occult blood test, fecal ova and parasite tests, and hydrogen breath tests looking for any sign of lactose intolerance. Now, if there's any diagnostic uncertainty, any alarming symptoms, or any severely resistant symptoms, then patients should be referred to secondary care. So, patients who have possible IBS should be referred for further investigation if any red flag symptoms are present. And these may be unintentional weight loss, rectal bleeding, a family history of bowel or ovarian cancer, and if they're over 60 and a change in bowel habit for more than 6 weeks with looser or more frequent stools. Patients who have possible IBS should be referred for further investigations if they have anemia, any abdominal or rectal masses, or any raised inflammatory markers, because this may be a sign of inflammatory bowel disease. And finally, I'll just talk about how we manage irritable bowel syndrome. Now, reassurance and explanation of this condition is really important, and a frank explanation of the course of the disease. Often patients will fear cancer, but careful and repeated explanation of the nature of the disease will reduce these fears. And then in terms of further management, it's often a case of what patients can do for themselves and then what we can do for patients. So what can patients do for themselves? Well, there are lifestyle changes, so ensuring regular exercise, making the best use of any leisure time, but also ensuring that they're having relaxation times and avoiding stressful triggers. And then there's diets, so regular meals, avoiding long gaps between meals and not rushing them, having lots of fluids, reducing any intake of alcohol and fizzy drinks, and limiting any high fiber foods such as wholemeal flour. But this obviously would depend on the main predominant symptoms. So patients who have constipation as the predominant feature, they may need to increase fiber intake, whereas those with diarrhea may find doing the opposite as beneficial. If patients struggle managing their diet themselves, then a referral to a dietitian would be warranted. And there's interest in the use of FODMAPs. So FODMAPs are fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, which are thought to cause some symptoms of IBS. So food sources high in FODMAPs are apples, cherries, nectarines, artificial sweeteners, lactose-containing foods, and a lot of green vegetables such as broccoli and cabbage and Brussels sprouts. So these can increase symptoms of IBS, and patients have often reported that a low FODMAP diet can help with their symptoms. And then it's about what we can do for patients. So there are a number of pharmacological treatments that are used for IBS. Whether they are truly effective or there is a placebo effect is debatable. If patients have diarrhea as a predominant feature, then they may benefit from an anti-motility agent such as loperamide. Also, patients who suffer from abdominal pain, discomfort, and spasms, any antispasmodic agents could be tried, such as hyoscine. Peppermint oil has also been shown to be effective as both an antispasmodic and for abdominal bloating, and it's not thought to have many adverse effects. If constipation is the predominant feature, then laxatives can be used. And also, antidepressants have been shown to have some benefit, just like in other chronic pain conditions, so tricyclic antidepressants such as amitriptyline and SSRIs have been thought to be effective. And the NICE guidelines actually advocate the use of an SSRI only if a low-dose tricyclic has not been effective. So for example, low-dose 10 milligrams amitriptyline and then increasing it as necessary to 30 milligrams. And then going away from the non-pharmacological therapies, so psychological therapies such as cognitive behavioral therapy, mindfulness, hypnotherapy have been used, especially if patients are not responding to any other treatment options after a year. But there is limited evidence for this. The best evidence available is for hypnotherapy, but it's only used in specialist centres. And then things like herbal therapies are available, but their evidence again remains unclear. The last thing I just mentioned is the prognosis. So patients with IBS will likely have it for the rest of their lives, and symptoms will fluctuate over the course of their life depending on external factors like stress, and ongoing stress may actually hinder recovery. But it is well known that a number of medical conditions will appear with greater frequency in people with IBS, and these can be split according to systems, so neurological or psychiatric conditions such as fibromyalgia, anxiety, depression, and chronic fatigue syndrome are more associated with people with IBS. IBS has also been marginally associated with inflammatory bowel disease. Abdominal surgery, so people with IBS have been at an increased risk of having unnecessary gallbladder surgery removal, not due to an increased risk of gallstones, but because of abdominal pain. Endometriosis, so some studies report a statistically significant link between migraine headaches, IBS, and endometriosis. The biggest issue with IBS is just how debilitating it can be and how it can significantly affect somebody's quality of life, which may lead to result in either missed school or missed work, and then effects on psychological health, so anxiety, depression, chronic fatigue. And that's the main issue, and the fact that there's no one curative treatment for it, and patients will likely have it for the rest of their life, and it just depends on how bad their symptoms are and what things can be done to alleviate their symptoms. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and found it useful. As always, please remember to give us your feedback, and the best way to do that is to leave a comment on the Apple Podcast platform. Share these episodes with your friends and your peers who may also find them useful, and you can check out all of our other episodes in both the gastroenterology and also the other sections, part of the Finals Countdown series, which are all available completely for free on any podcast platform such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google. You can check out our social media platforms, Instagram, Facebook, by just searching MedTalks for more regular updates. And if you have any questions about any of these episodes, or you want to get involved in some of these podcasts, just feel free to message us on these social media platforms. Alternatively, you can email us, and our email address is hellomedtalks@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening. All the best with your revision, and stay tuned for the upcoming episodes. Goodbye.